Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Very happy to be with you on this Friday afternoon. Jimmy Akin, our guest both hours, and it's Ask Me Anything Catholicism. This time, all the questions are in, which is what I have to say is always kind of fun because we get curated questions. Jimmy, thanks for being here with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Cy Kellett.
I got an opener for you. And actually, this comes up so much, and I am so curious to hear what you have to say about this. Is there such a thing as a generational curse?
Okay, so let's talk about this one. There is a basis for the idea of generational curses in the Old Testament. For example, in the Ten Commandments, it says that that God will, you know, punish to the third and fourth generation, but on the other hand, he will bless to the thousandth generation of those who love him. And so even there, even when you have kind of the inception of, you know, the idea of what you could understand as a generational curse, there's an exception. So like if you are one of those who love God, it's going to trump any lingering generational problem. So it raises a hesitancy about just any kind of declaration that, you know, this is an unqualified concept that people should just accept. And the reasons for that hesitancy mount as we go further in the Old Testament, because, you know, as Jesus indicated, the God's method of communicating with the early Israelites was limited. They had hard hearts, they had certain concepts they were attached to, and we don't find the full revelation of God's true will until we get to the time of Jesus. But even before that, at the time of the Babylonian exile, we have clarifying passages from the prophets like Jeremiah and Ezekiel, who are saying things like, there was this proverb at the time, the fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth have been set on edge. You know, like when you bite into something really sour. And so the idea is our fathers have sinned, but we're suffering for it now. And, you know, there's a naturalistic element of truth there. In that if, you know, let's say you're a father and you got a fortune and then you blow it all on gambling, so your children grow up in poverty, well, okay, your children are suffering because of what you did. Mm-hmm. But that's purely natural. And the Israelites were taking it in the sense of our fathers did something bad spiritually that honked off God, and now God's harming us because of what our fathers did spiritually, not naturally. And the prophets Ezekiel and Jeremiah both said, don't you go saying this proverb anymore. God is not going to punish people who did not sin. If someone sins, that's the person God will punish. And if the person does not sin, that's the person God will bless. So this did further damage to the idea of a generational curse as something that's an ongoing, perduring reality or thing that God does. So that of itself is reason for, we're not even out of the Old Testament period yet. It's made clear in the New Testament that God loves everybody. Jesus died for everybody. He wants everybody to be saved, and everyone has a relationship with God that, you know, they're going to stand or fall based on what they do. That's something the New Testament makes clear. So as a result of this development of revelation, of this progressive revelation, the idea of generational curses has not really been a thing in Christian history. All right. And it's not in church teaching.
Okay.
Until, oh, and it's still not oh. in, it, I'm not done.
Okay. I was like, wait a second. Okay.
That's a, that's a dramatic pause.
Well, you got me with it. Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
So it has not been a thing in Christian history until very recently. And you will hear some exorcists now touting this idea and saying, oh yeah, generational curses are a real thing. Your ancestor could have done something bad and now you're going to get harmed for it, and therefore you need to do various things to undo this generational curse so it won't apply to you. Well, this is not church teaching. This is not an established element in Catholic theological opinion. It's something new, and there is a division in the exorcist community over this. This is something a lot of people don't realize. They may have one exorcist or a few exorcists that are kind of pop culture exorcists that they listen to, and they assume that, oh, well, this exorcist said this, so it must be this is what exorcists believe. And it's not. There you'll hear a lot of exorcists touting opinions that that may be their opinion, but are not church teaching, are not broader opinions in the Catholic theological community, and that aren't even accepted among other exorcists. And this is one of them. This is, I would say, a fringe theory that is not widely shared. And in fact, the International Association of Exorcists has taken a position against this view. They had commissioned a study done of, well, where, how did this idea get in to the modern exorcistic community? And it turns out it came in from non-Catholic circles. The idea of generational curses began to be popularized in the late 20th century from the Protestant charismatic movement. And it got into Protestant exorcistic circles there, and then it jumped to certain Catholic exorcistic circles. At least that is the basic historical outline that the International Association of Exorcists traced for it. So I would say this is a very problematic opinion. It is not one that has been condemned explicitly by the church, but it also is not one that has been in any way endorsed by the church. It is not part of Catholic teaching. It is a fringe opinion of certain exorcists, and I don't see it as being well grounded in the data. I would view this as a form of superstition. In particular, I mean, who is it that is even supposed to be inflicting this curse on people? Is it God? Because if you want to appeal to Old Testament passages, like where it says God is going to hold people accountable to the third and fourth generation of those who hate him, well, it's God who's doing that. But if you listen to these modern exorcists, it's not God. It's like demons. You know, it's like somehow your father became a Freemason and somehow that attracted demons to your line or something. And it's not even the same kind of a curse. It's not something that God is doing. It's something that's being done by demons. So this is a very problematic area. I view it as a form of superstition. I have a major book, or I have a book that has a major section on this idea and its history that is in Spanish, and I'm having the relevant section translated into English. And once that's done, I plan on doing an episode of Mysterious World where I look at this in more detail.
Oh, I'm glad to hear it. As you were speaking, wait, that wasn't a dramatic pause, right?
You can talk now pause.
It almost seems like there's sometimes we have this thing, expertise creep, where you, an expert in one area, it kind of creeps over. And the truth is, an exorcist is not necessarily a theologian. It's not necessarily a
They might be.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is something that, you know, exorcists, if you think in terms of their function in the church, they're bouncers. You know, they're like a bouncer at a bar.
Yeah.
You got a patron in a bar. He's causing problems. You need him ejected. You get the bouncer to do it. Well, you got a spirit in the church. It's causing problems. You want it ejected. You get an exorcist to do it. So functionally, they're bouncers. if they know more than that, and many of them do, you know, then that's additional competence besides their bouncer function. And it's good that they have that. Unfortunately, many of them are not theologically well-formed, and that causes problems, especially when people attribute special insight to them that the office of exorcist does not itself carry.
You mentioned Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, so I'll ask you now. We'll look forward to the episode upcoming on generational curses. Already more than 400 episodes there. And by the way, if you haven't discovered Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, you are in for a treat. But what dropped this morning on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World?
Part two of our look at the idea that the Zodiac Killer from the late 1960s never existed, that it was a hoax. Last week, we introduced this idea. We carried the analysis up to a certain point of showing why the four canonical Zodiac crimes, why people would think they're connected and think they were all committed by the same person. And this week, we're going into, okay, now the Zodiac Killer hoax idea gets its day, and we're going to look at its claims about how these crimes should really be interpreted, and then see whether or not those that proposal stands up to examination or not.
Check out Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, mysterious.fm. You can go to anywhere where you get your podcasts. You can put in Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, or you can go to Jimmy's YouTube channel. You can get that and the Jimmy Akin podcasts there. Do check it out. We'll take a quick break and be right back with more Jimmy Akin on Ask Me Anything About Catholicism on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at magnificat.com.
He was a 10th century saint, priest, mystic, and doctor of the Church, honored as the first poet of Armenia.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
Gregory of Narek is revered by Armenians as a watchful angel in human form. His masterwork, the Book of Lamentations, was intended to be his last testament, an encyclopedia of prayer for all nations. He was named a Doctor of the Church in 2015.
To find out more, visit EWTN.com and click on Catholicism.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. People have all kinds of problems, Jimmy. This is not a problem that has ever occurred to me in my life, but I don't know where Wayne Hello lives. But Wayne Hello One. I apologize. I apologize to Wayne Hello Two and following. Wayne Hello One, an interesting question, but actually one that, as I said, it hasn't come up in my life. Could you please summarize the Church's teaching on food offered to other gods? Is it a sin to eat it if it's offered to me, or is it fine if I just think of it as something to eat?
Well, this is a problem that doesn't tend to come up in certainly in the Western world in our day, because a lot of food is not offered to gods at all. But this was more of a problem in the first century in the Greco-Roman world, because people would offer food to gods, and then since the gods wouldn't consume it, you sometimes had the food left over. And what are you going to do with this food? I mean, it's going to go bad. And the gods, you know, maybe they spiritually ate it, but they didn't physically eat it. So you got this perfectly usable food left over. You might sell it. And so people in various towns, you know, meat back then was sometimes food, not an everyday food. And so you'd have kind of like cookies with Cookie Monster these days. Cookies are a sometimes food, apparently. And
I didn't know that. Okay, a sometimes food.
They've revised Cookie Monster. So meat was a sometimes food. It wasn't something people could afford every day. In fact, that has persisted until fairly recent times. I remember when I was a kid, I was going over to the house of a friend and to hang out, and I was going to eat dinner with his family, and he was so excited because since I was coming and I was a guest, that meant they got to eat meat that night.
Oh.
You know, and that's in 20th century America.
Wow.
And yeah. So they'd have this, you don't just throw usable food away. And so they would often sell meat that had been sacrificed in a temple in the meat market in various towns, and people would buy it. And many of these people were pagans. And then they might invite over a Christian guest and say, here's our dinner tonight. You're a guest, so we're eating meat tonight. Here's the meat. Please have some. And you're a Christian going, this was offered to Zeus, wasn't it, up in Zeus's temple? How do you deal with that situation? Well, St. Paul discusses this in two of his letters. He discusses it in 1 Corinthians and also in Romans chapter 14. And the solution, now, some Christians thought it was you just should not eat this meat. You should just avoid it. And that's something that was a viewpoint that was at least somewhat endorsed at the Acts 15 Council of Jerusalem, where they said, okay, you Gentiles, you don't need to be circumcised, you don't need to become Jews, but since Moses has been taught in all these cities for a long time, for the sake of peace, we want you to do at least these four things, and one of them was abstain from meat offered to idols.
Right.
But that seems to have been a peacekeeping regulation so that Jewish and Gentile Christians could get along together. And it doesn't seem to have been an absolute permanent prohibition. And so in 1 Corinthians and in Romans, St. Paul takes a bit of a different line. He's more open to the idea of eating meat that has been offered to idols, because an idol, as St. Paul points out, is nothing. You know, and so it doesn't mm-hmm. change the meat just because someone offered it to a nothing. And there's no reason in principle you couldn't eat it. So what St. Paul says is, he says a few things. One of them, he says, is if someone offers it to you, then you can just go ahead and eat it and don't raise any questions. You know,
oh yeah.
So it's like if someone says, hey, Christian, glad you could come over. Since you're an honored guest, we get to eat meat tonight and in your honor, and here's some of it. Enjoy. Don't say, well, wait, wasn't this offered to Zeus up in Zeus's temple? Paul says, don't raise that question. Just eat it. Yeah. And so that answers one of Wayne Hello One's questions. Is it a sin to eat it if it's offered to me? No, as long as you recognize that there is no spiritual significance to this.
Mm-hmm.
He also says, well, is it fine if I just think of it as something to eat? So here the meat's not being offered to Wayne Hello One. Maybe he goes to the market and the only meat available is this meat has been offered to Zeus. Could he buy it for himself and then just think of it as something to eat and eat it? And based on St. Paul's principle that an idol is nothing and you can eat this meat in principle, yeah, he could. Wayne Hello One could do that too. So that wouldn't be a problem. Where it would be a problem is if Wayne Hello One thought that this is a spiritually significant act and that you're somehow participating in the worship of Zeus.
Mm-hmm.
And St. Paul says, don't do that. Then you're acting contrary to your faith in Christ, and that would be a sin. So Paul says, let everybody be convinced in your own mind. Yes, it's fine to eat this meat as long as you recognize there's no spiritual significance to it. But if you think that it is spiritually significant, I mean, if you sincerely believe that as opposed to just having a scruple about it, well, then you shouldn't eat. But, and he also has he has his own version of the how can we get along principle by saying, if you cause someone else who doesn't recognize that this is spiritually insignificant, if you cause that person who thinks it is significant to eat, then you're tempting that person into sin, so don't do that. You have the freedom to eat the meat, but don't exercise it if you're going to cause someone else to fall into sin.
Ah, gotcha. All right. Well, Wayne, hello, one. Thank you very much for the question. Oh, my goodness. Papuchawi, 1465. I'm sorry if I'm butchering that. When does illegally acquired power become legal? Ooh, for example, when can a Chinese person stop obeying the authorities in Taiwan and henceforth honor the ruling communists?
So Papuchioi is envisioning a scenario where, like, mainland China invades and takes over Taiwan.
Oh, it's a hypothetical. Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. So at what point could a person stop obeying the Taiwanese authorities and start obeying the mainland Chinese authorities? The answer is that effectively when rule shifts from one group of rulers to the other. And when that happens is difficult to discern. Mm-hmm. But fundamentally, when the Taiwanese authorities have lost control of the island and the mainland authorities have gained control of it, they have had an effective shift of government. And so that's when obeying the mainland authorities would become the thing to do. It's after the local authorities have lost power and the other authorities have gained power. Now, you can ask finer grain questions about when exactly does that happen. And like, so there would be a war between the two parties. And at some point on this scenario, it would become clear that the Taiwanese authorities are going to lose in this scenario. I mean, in the real world, they might win. Mm-hmm. But in this scenario that Papuchioi is describing, the Taiwanese lose. And so at some point in the war, it would become clear that they are going to lose and that continuing the fighting is just going to lead to further harm. And that's the point at which I would say continuing to prosecute the war serves no good purpose and mm-hmm. only creates harms. And that would be the point to surrender. And the point of that where you should surrender, even if your leaders have not surrendered, would be the point at which obeying the mainland authorities would become legitimate. So, but it's in a war situation, it can be very hard to discern these things. So I'm not going to blame people for the decisions they make in the middle of wartime like this. And God understands the cognitive limitations that people are dealing with in a wartime.
Right, right.
You know, some people might think, oh, we've reached the point where we need to surrender. Other people might think, oh, no, we're not at that point yet. And so so people can have different opinions on this. God knows what the truth is. And as long as you're acting in a sincere way based on what you believe at present, God is going to take that into account.
I hope this hypothetical never happens, but thank you very much for the question. I won't repeat the name, but Jimmy did it better than I did. This one comes from John Henry Says Hi. What a great last name. John Henry Says Hi wants to know, yes, can you please explain when, if ever, it is okay to disobey laws and rules? Also, while vigilantism is against Catholic teaching, when, if ever, is it appropriate to try to restore justice as ordinary citizens, if corruption has gone so far? Sorry, I know this is very broad, but I appreciate any thoughts. Thank you so much. God bless you always, Jimmy.
Okay, so I would say that vigilantism is not always contrary to Catholic teaching. I would say it's not desirable. But if law enforcement has effectively broken down or is not dealing with an urgent situation, I would say extra legal pursuit of justice is sometimes morally justifiable. So, you know, if you're in Gotham City and the police are all just corrupt, Batman could be a legitimate solution to crime problems if the actual authorities are not dealing with the crime that is urgently harming people. Mm-hmm. Having said that, when is it okay to disobey laws and rules? Well, the Catechism of the Catholic Church gives us some guidance on that. In paragraph 2242, and by the way, I'll have to continue this on the other side of the break, but in paragraph 2242, it says the citizen is obliged in conscience not to follow the directives of civil authorities when they are contrary to the demands of the moral order. So you're given an immoral order by the authorities, you disobey that. To the fundamental, or when they're contrary to the fundamental rights of persons or the teachings of the gospel. Refusing obedience to the civil authorities when their demands are contrary to those of an upright conscience finds its justification in the distinction between serving God and serving the political community. Render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's, and which is a quotation from Jesus, and then it also quotes the apostles from the book of Acts saying we must obey God rather than men. When citizens are under oppression, are under the oppression of a public authority which oversteps its competence, they should still not refuse to give or to do what is objectively demanded of them by the common good. Mm. But there's more to say, and we'll continue that on the other side of the break.
All right, John Henry says hi. Thank you for the question. We'll take that break. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's Ask Me Anything on Catholicism, and all the questions are already in, so we'll get the end of John Henry's answer, and then more questions for Jimmy right after this on Catholic Answers Live. Why do Catholics pray to dead people, bow to statues, venerate relics? And where do we find any of this stuff in the Bible? In the delightful book, The Saints Pray for You, Dr. Carla Broussard convincingly defends the ancient Christian belief rooted in Scripture that the saints care for us, that they're our allies. Order your copy of The Saints Pray for You today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Why We're Catholic is the one book you can hand to anyone to invite them into or back to the Catholic faith. With more than 400,000 copies sold, Trent Horn's book has had a number one ranking on Amazon.com for 5 years running. Now available in softcover, bulk cases, ebook, and on Audible. Find out what the excitement is all about. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic at shop.catholic.com or visit whyweearecatholic.com.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world. But it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron. Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest. And John Henry says, hi, had a question about when it's appropriate for two things, basically. When do you stop having to obey the law? Is there a time for that? And then is there ever a time where vigilantism is acceptable? And Jimmy, you were in the midst of your answer.
Yeah, so I was reading from paragraph 2242 of the Catechism, and it says that basically you're not obliged to follow the directives of the civil authorities when they're demanding that you do something that you shouldn't. And it gives some categories of things like that. It then goes on to say when citizens are under the oppression of a public authority which oversteps its competence, they, the citizens, should still not refuse to give or to do what is objectively demanded of them by the common good. So, you know, if the even if the state's overstepping in some regions, that doesn't mean that you disobey it utterly in everything. There's still the common good that needs to be looked after, and you need to cooperate even with a bad state when it's promoting the common good. So it's so you don't always just disobey everything the state says. But, it continues, it is legitimate for them, the citizens, to defend their own rights and those of their fellow citizens against the abuse of this authority within the limits of the natural law and the gospel. So there are limits. Now, this is dealing with the principles that need to be applied in such a situation. Applying them is actually something that gets messier. But those are the principles, and so I'd refer John Henry Says Hi to paragraph 2242 for more information about that. You know, he can look at what it says and think about it in more detail and so forth. He also asks about trying to restore justice as an ordinary citizen if corruption has gone too far. And it, to my mind, that is vigilantism.
Yeah.
The Catechism doesn't have a Batman paragraph that outlines vigilantism. It does have a paragraph. In fact, it's the very next paragraph, which is 2243, on armed resistance to the state, which is like starting a rebellion, but that's not the same thing as vigilantism. If you want to know what it says about armed resistance to the state, read 2243. I would say that that private exaction of justice is something that has to be done very rarely and very carefully, and only after other alternatives have been exhausted. And a good example of that is in the song Goodbye Earl by the Dixie Chicks. In this song, it tells the story of a woman who marries early and ends up in an abusive marriage, and her husband puts her in the hospital. And she calls her best friend, who comes over, and they try reporting it to the legal authorities, who do nothing. And so these two women have tried to deal with the problem through the regular legal means. The regular authorities have proven themselves either unable or unwilling to deal with the problem. It is a threat to the woman's life because she's already been put in the hospital by Earl.
Right.
And that's when they realized that Earl had to die. And the song tells us the story of how that happened. This is one of the great, you know, part of the great tradition of country western songs known as a murder ballad.
Oh.
And if you do an analysis, and it's been a while since I've done one, but my memory is if you do an analysis of the decisions that the women make in the song Goodbye Earl, they're actually justified. Because, you know, they've tried to deal with this. It is a genuine threat. They've tried to deal with it the right way. They can't get it dealt with the right, you know, the ordinary way. And so they take matters into their own hands. And that would be justified if all of these circumstances prevail. So, that would be an example of even if it's in a comedic country song, of going through the kind of reasoning that needs to be done in order to get to a justified application of private justice rather than public justice.
Goodbye, Earl. I haven't heard that song. I'll listen to it after. I have to say, I love the Catechism of the Catholic Church, but the fact that there is no Batman paragraph, that does seem to be an oversight.
I would assume there is one in the DC universe.
Yeah, probably. There's probably a Batman paragraph in the DC universe Catechism of the Catholic Church. if this is, I can't sound this out to make it into anything, so I'm just going to say it the way it is, and you could tell me if I missed the joke here. Nkata Nanel.
Could say that, or Nkata Nanel, all something right. like that.
Klaatu Barada Niktu. All right, how can we be happy in heaven before the general resurrection if happiness is dependent on chemicals in our brain?
I see. Well, normally people ask me questions about, you know, this island Earth, but if you want to ask me questions about heaven, I'm happy to deal with those. You know, I mean, someday the Earth will stand still and we'll all be up in heaven.
All right, kids, Jimmy's doing a 1950s science fiction movie reference for you there if you missed it.
Well, you said Klaatu Barada Niktu. Yeah, that's from The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Right, one of the greats. One of the great movies.
Okay, so how can we be in heaven before the general resurrection if happiness is dependent on chemicals in our brain? Well, there are different ways of answering this question, but I'll tell you the way that I find most attractive. The brain, so there is a correlation between happiness in this life and chemicals in our brain. You know, you introduce some chemicals, you're going to feel happy. You introduce other chemicals, you're going to feel scared. You introduce other chemicals, you're going to feel depressed. Sometimes the same chemical can have more than one effect. You might, there are illegal drugs that people take for pleasure, and then sometimes they have a bad trip. So there is clearly a relationship in this life between mood and thus happiness and chemicals in the brain. But that doesn't mean that it's dependent on these chemicals, just that it's affected by these chemicals. And there's actually significant evidence that our brain does not generate consciousness. It merely interacts with consciousness. And this itself would be suggested by the fact that there is an afterlife. Because if consciousness was generated by the physical organ of the brain, then consciousness would stop as soon as the brain stops working and there would be no afterlife. So the mere Christian vision of the nature of man should tell you that there is more to consciousness than just the activity of the brain. This is also suggested by the findings of science. We have very good, numerous cases of near-death experiences where someone's heart stopped and thus it stopped delivering blood to their brain, and your brain shuts off within, you know, like 10 or 15 seconds of loss of blood flow. So you should have no conscious experiences, you know, once that happens. And yet people continue to have conscious experiences in a state of clinical death when their heart is stopped, and they are able to report accurate information that they did not previously know before their experience, and that turns out to be true, and that is too specific for random chance to explain. This is called veridical information. And I won't give examples of that because I've done that before here on the show. But that would also suggest that consciousness is independent of the brain. So how would we think about the brain in that case? Well, a common model that you'll hear proposed for discussion purposes is maybe the brain is what's known as a transducer. Transducers are things that transform one kind of signal into another. So, for example, we have eyes. Eyes take visible light that comes into the eye, and it goes back to our retina where it gets turned into a nerve impulse, which is an electrochemical signal that travels up our optic nerve into our brain, into the visual center of our brain, which is the back of the head. So our eyes are transducers. They change visible light into electrochemical signals that go to the brain. What about our ears? Our ears take acoustic radiation or sound from the air and translate it into electrochemical signals that go to the brain. What about the nerves that cover our skin? Those take additional signals, you know, like pressure and pain and temperature and so forth, and translate them into electrochemical signals that then go to the brain. Well, how do we know? So we're actually covered. Same thing with our tongue. Same thing with our sense of balance from the little bones in our ears. Every physical sense we have involves a transducer that changes some kind of external environmental signal into an electrochemical signal that goes to the brain. Well, how do we know the brain's not a transducer whose job is to interface with consciousness and take all these electrochemical signals and present them to our consciousness? Now, I've mentioned the biological transducers we have, but for purposes of this analogy, it may help to mention that we've got technological or artificial transducers as well, like microphones, telephones, radios, and televisions, and computers. You know, they take electrical signals and turn them into other forms of signals that are useful to us in various ways. But if you think about, let's say you've got a computer monitor and it's going to have various controls that probably normally you don't touch, but your computer monitor is a transducer. If you're watching this video online, what it's doing is taking internet signals and turning them into visual signals of Cy and me talking to each other. Mm-hmm. So it's transducing. But if you start fiddling with the controls of your monitor, you might be able to affect the color balance. So you could make Cy's skin turn bright red if you twist the knob one way or turn the setting one way. Or you might be able to make Cy look black and white if you turn it a completely different way. So you could affect the perceived color of Cy's skin by messing with the transducer. Okay, that's an analogy for putting those chemicals in your body that make you happy or sad or scared or something like that.
Oh,
and so you could affect what the transducer is doing, but that doesn't mean it's the cause of the thing that it is transducing. So like even if you're fiddling with your monitor's color balance to make Cy turn pretty colors or lose all color, because, you know, he's pretty pale.
People point that out all the time.
Yeah, but it's not your monitor that causes Cy to have skin or causes his skin to have a particular color in real life. And so if the brain is a transducer, then yes, chemicals you introduce into the brain, particularly those that cross the blood-brain barrier, are ones that could have an effect on your mood and whether you're happy or not. But that doesn't mean that this is the only way you can be happy, any more than making Cy have bright red skin on your monitor means that Cy's skin has changed in real life. So we could continue to have consciousness without our bodies and without our brains, and we could still be happy in heaven prior to the general resurrection, just without the biological transducer we normally have in this life.
Oh, that was a fun one. I'm not going to repeat. Well, all right. Nkatananel, thank you very much for that question. We'll take a quick break. Right back with more questions for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, when we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue. Her remedy? Works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
Mother Angelica had a simple goal when she began EWTN, to reach the world with the gospel message. EWTN is the most trusted source of authentically Catholic content on the air today, 24/7, television, radio, social media, and podcasts. We've never wavered from our mandate to proclaim the truth and majesty of the Catholic faith. Thank you for joining EWTN in this mission.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live, Jimmy Akin, our guest. Time is flying, I guess because these questions are fun. We've got a whole bunch of questions already in for Jimmy today. This one comes from Deutscher Michelle, 5807. Mm-hmm. And Deutscher Michelle wants to know, is a Pope Emeritus still a cardinal? Oh, or would the next Pope need to create his predecessor as cardinal again so that he could vote in a conclave again? Wow.
So this is an area that there may be a technical answer in current canon law that exists, but I have not seen anyone discuss it. And it also may be an area where there's a lacuna in the law, meaning a hole in the law that has not yet been filled. It could take something like a ruling from the Dicastery for Legislative Texts to settle this question. Functionally, the Pope Emeritus that the only Pope Emeritus we've had under the current Code of Canon Law was Benedict XVI. And when he retired, he wanted to make it clear, I am retiring from any form of ecclesiastical governance. I do not want my successor to have me as a legislative ghost hovering over his shoulder that he has to worry about. So Benedict, after he resigned from the papacy, effectively renounced not only papal authority but all authority in the church except those abilities that are inherent to episcopal ordination. So like he could still say mass, he could still hear your confession, you know, things like that. But any other form of governance he renounced. My impression is that popes effectively renounce their status as cardinal upon becoming elected pope. That's what I'm less sure of. I could see someone saying, well, even though they're functioning as the pope now, their cardinal status technically remains, but I'd have to see that argued because they don't function like regular cardinals anymore. They have a different and greater office, and the whole purpose of a cardinal is to assist the pope. Well, if you're pope now, then you're not one of your own assistants anymore.
No.
So I would tend to say, barring a ruling from the Dicastery for Legislative Texts, that popes renounce their status or lose their status as cardinal upon becoming pope, and therefore they don't regain it upon renouncing the papacy. Should they renounce the papacy, what happens may well be the same thing that happened with Pope Benedict. He died before the next conclave, so there was no question of him voting in the next conclave. However, if the successor pope were to rename the individual as cardinal, and if that person accepted that role, then they could go on to vote in the conclave. But this is not something that Pope Benedict was interested in doing. He also died too soon, but he really wanted to stay out of governance so as not to be an impediment to his successor. And I suspect future popes emeritus are likely to take the same path. Having said that, it's not impossible that an emeritus pope could vote in the next conclave. He could even be a candidate. He could even win the next conclave if his successor dies before he does or renounces the papacy before he does. I would view that as a very surprising turn of events, but based on my present understanding, which could be corrected, I would say he'd need to be named a cardinal again in order to vote.
Boy, you really thought of one there, Deutscher. Thanks very much for the question. This one comes from Eric M. Sell. Is it an additional sin to delay a confession if you know you need to go? Someone on X argued Aquinas says delaying confession is not a sin. I argued that he says it's impractical to go immediately, but it can still be a sin depending on your access to a priest and why you delay.
So, okay. There is an obligation to go to confession when you've sinned, but that obligation does not mean that you have to do it as soon as possible. You know, for mm-hmm. example, there's the requirement that we confess our mortal sins at least once a year. So there is a canonical requirement, which reflects an even more basic moral requirement. The canonical requirement to confess once a year, mortal sins once a year, is a specification of the more general moral requirement to go to confession after we've committed a mortal sin. But you don't have to do it immediately, and that can be impractical for a whole bunch of reasons. The standard opinion among moralists has been, this is my understanding of the standard opinion, and I've done some reading on this, but it's been a while, is that that you only get a positive obligation to go to confession when there's a special reason to, beyond the 1 year rule. Like, for example, I'm in a place where there is no normal access to priests, and I've committed a mortal sin, and a priest is coming into town. He's only going to be here for like a week, and then he's going to go away, and he's not going to come back for 2 years. And I'm not going to have access to a priest for 2 years. Okay, now I've got an argument to go now while I have access to the priest. Or suppose I've got a delicate medical condition and could drop dead at any moment. Well, okay, go now. Go to confession now while you have the ability before you suddenly drop dead. Or suppose I need the strength I'll gain from confession in order to avoid that mortal sin.
Mm.
And I'll be putting myself in danger of that same sin or another one if I don't go to confession. So I'm in proximate occasion of mortal sin if I don't go. Well, then go now. So there's generally not an obligation to go to confession on any particular timetable other than confess mortal sins at least once a year, which does not have to be at Easter. People often confuse this obligation with the Easter duty to receive communion, but confession does not have to be at Easter time. It can be at any time during the year, and it only needs to be for mortal sins, not venial sins. So you don't have any mortal sins, you don't got to go to confession once a year. But if you do have a mortal sin, you generally can wait up to a year to confess under the law. But if there are special circumstances, like access to a priest or a delicate medical condition, a dangerous medical condition, or danger of committing the same sin, if you don't go to confession, depending on how your personal psychology works and what benefits you receive from confession, then there can be an obligation to go more swiftly than that.
Okay. All right. So now I do think, Jimmy, some people are going to be, I know this surprised me when I learned about it as an adult. Mm-hmm. They don't know what the Easter obligation is as far as communion. So could you just tell me what that is?
The Easter duty is to receive Holy Communion normally during the Easter season. But here it has been, in the United States, it's been expanded so you can do it earlier than Easter, and you can also do it all the way through the end of the Easter season. I'd have to look to verify the exact Sundays that in the United States it spans, and maybe I can do that during the break and report on that. I just want to refresh my memory to make sure I name the right ones.
Sure.
The Easter duty itself is defeasible, though, meaning there are situations that can warrant you not fulfilling this during the Easter season. And if those, if that applies, then you can fulfill it at some other time during the year. So it's still an annual obligation. It is normally fulfilled in the Easter season or proximate to Easter. But after the break, I'll be able to give you the exact details on that.
Okay. All right. Very good. So Jimmy Akin is our guest. We've got a whole bunch of questions. There's not even a chance we could run out of questions. And they're really good. So hang on for another hour. Jimmy, of course, I mentioned it, but do visit Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, mysterious.fm, or check out wherever you get your podcasts. Check it out at Jimmy Akin's YouTube channel. What I didn't ask Jimmy about was the Jimmy Akin podcast, which comes on the other end of the work week. And we'll ask him about that when we come back, because so many cool things dropping week after week at the Jimmy Akin podcast. We're going to take a very quick break. As I said, loads of questions still to come. Jimmy Akin, our guest next hour, right back with more Catholic Answers Live.